Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
The idea that an unequal capitalist economy will outperform in productivity a more egalitarian capitalist economy, there is absolutely no evidence to substantiate that. As a matter of fact, there's overwhelming evidence that it's exactly the opposite.
That's the voice of economist Robin Hinnell. In this week's show, we speak to Robin Hinnell and how the economy functions in part one of a four-part series about the economy and how it affects our everyday lives and how it interacts with the political social sphere. So stay tuned.
You are listening to Latin Waves. We are very privileged this afternoon to be joined by Dr. Robin Hinnell. And we are facing a series of questions. You know, we're approaching one of the most important elections perhaps on the planet, the election of a presidential candidate for the U.S. And on the mind of people, usually the top question is the economy. But very little is shared in terms of education in school about what is an economy. So why don't we begin there, Robin?
Well, what's important about the economy is that it produces the goods and services that we need, and it provides people with work. And what we now understand that we didn't understand before, we used to think, well, the only important goal is to increase economic productivity, basically reduce the number of hours that people have to work to get the same amount of goods and services, or produce more goods and services, you know, every hour that we work. Besides that, sort of distributing the goods and services fairly, that was always a concern. I mean, it was a concern of some people, much less of a concern of others. The mainstream of the economics profession increasingly adopted the attitude, well, that's not our problem. Our problem is to tell people how to produce more goods and services and fewer in less time. But how it is that it's distributed and whether it's going to be distributed fairly, we'll leave that to philosophers and politicians, which was always a huge cop-out. But the other thing we have figured out is that we now have to pay attention. We live in a mostly full world, not a mostly empty world, to use a phrase from the ecological from ecological economists. And because we live in a full world, it means that we have to start worrying about how rapidly we're using scarce resources from the natural environment. And increasingly, what's even more important is how much we are using up environmental sinks to store the waste products that we produce. The most important environmental sink right now is the upper atmosphere, where we store carbon emissions from our economic activity. So that's what we should care about. We should care about whether or not we're getting more useful goods and services per hour of our work. As long as work is less pleasant than leisure, then productivity increases are beneficial. You want to share those productivity increases fairly, and you want to do it in a way that does not increase strain on the natural environment. Those are the important things. We are not doing well in any of those regards at present. What we should not be distracted by is, are stock prices going up or down? Is the value of my house going up or down? Well, that is something that a person has to worry about. It's usually, for an ordinary person, if they own a house, it's practically the only wealth that they own. But your house stays the same, even when its market price goes up and down, only because you have to worry that you're going to take a loss on a sale. Do you worry about things such as that? So the values of assets, particularly financial assets and stock prices, that's all incidental and only of importance if it affects the real things: production, productivity, environmental protection, and distributive justice, if you want to just make it simple.
Now, when we think about a productive economy, I grew up in Latin America, and most of our economies were agricultural economies. And often people think of feudalist society, you know, where the king reaps the benefits of the peasants working the lands, and you get 50% of everything you cultivate, you just give it away to the king, whoever's in charge. And so we are told that capitalism was a good thing, that it was a natural transition from feudalism to capitalism. And I think it's important to learn where we come from so that we know where we are, first of all, to situate ourselves, and also to ask the question, is where we're heading a good place to continue to be walking in? So can we talk a little bit about this sort of, you know, mythology, in my opinion, of, you know, this natural transition to a system of capitalism that displaced many and continues to create profits on the basis of displacement, expropriation, and, you know, impoverishing of others?
In the advanced economies, how are we performing as far as increases in labor productivity, as far as the distribution of the, you know, the goods and services that we are generating, that people are making, and how are we progressing in terms of, you know, whether or not we are protecting the environment? Well, in all those regards, the rise of neoliberalism in the 1980s right up to the present has basically diminished economic performance. Rates of growth of productivity in the advanced economies have slowed considerably. What little increases in productivity we have had over the past 30 years have been captured almost entirely by the top 1%. That's where the slogan for Occupy came from. It's a real actual number that over 80% of increases in economic productivity were captured by not just the top 1%, but in most cases, to a great degree, by the top 0.1% of wealthy people and rich people. And we have continued to simply spew pollutions into the environment and put ourselves in a situation where we have exhausted the sink services of the upper atmosphere as a storage place for our carbon emissions. So that's what's going on. I mean, that's a summary of how the economies have performed for people and the environment under the neoliberal period in the advanced economies over the past 30 years. And then on top of that, the financial system crashed the global economy and sent us into the greatest recession since the Great Depression. And in Europe, they really have failed to even sort of make a moderate comeback from all that. Now, if you look at Latin America, traditionally, as you know, the indigenous societies there had their own economies, which were certainly not capitalist economies, and they were not plantation agricultural economies. Those indigenous economies were virtually wiped out through disease and conquering and enslavement by the European settlers and colonial masters. And then what replaced them was an indigenous population that was sent to work in mines for extractive resources and who were enslaved basically as peasants on landed estates, large landed estates owned by European settlers, where productivity was very low. The owners of the landed estate lived quite well. The peasants who worked there for them, you know, had a very, very low standard of living. In the sort of early to mid-20th century, economists in Latin America, a very famous economist named Raul Prebisch, who was an Argentine economist, and he founded a division of the United Nations, ECLA, that did research on how could the economies of Latin America actually become productive economies, rather than a peripheral part of the global economy that provided agriculture and raw materials to the manufacturing centers and the advanced economies. And they developed a program in the middle of the century that began industrialization processes in the Latin American economies. The name for that was import substitution. The successful countries engaged in what all advanced economies had engaged in before, the United States in particular, to protect our small and infant manufacturing industry. We placed high tariffs on products imported, manufacturing products imported from Europe and Great Britain in particular. until we grew manufacturing industries that could compete on a global scale. And Prebisch basically preached that doctrine in Latin America, and it was called import substitution. So instead of importing all their manufactured goods and exporting agricultural goods and raw materials, mining products, what they tried to do was say, no, we want to produce our own manufactured goods for our own domestic consumption. And that is the only way that we're going to have increases in productivity so that people can live better in Latin America. Now, that strategy was, for a whole sorts of reasons, that strategy was sort of set aside in the 1980s, particularly in the late 70s and 80s. Latin America was the first region of the world that was subject to this great new experiment called neoliberalism. And it had disastrous effects. It was a huge setback for this sort of incipient process of industrialization and self-sufficiency in manufacture. And it was a disaster. It basically was a disaster for the economic well-being of most Latin American citizens. And as the first place where neoliberalism was unleashed, and as a place where the consequences were particularly dire, the political reaction against neoliberalism also came first in Latin America. And we now have a name for it. People are calling it the pink tide. But it was a change in strategy on the part of progressives and revolutionaries. It was a move away from guerrilla opposition to imperialist capitalism and imposed neoliberalism. Guerrilla opposition in countryside, urban guerrillaism in places like Uruguay. All of those political movements of the 60s and the 70s were replaced by new progressive left movements that opposed the neoliberal trend in the continent. And they pursued new ways of doing that. Instead of armed resistance and trying to liberate territories militarily and protect them militarily, the opposition basically changed in two huge directions. The first was they started to concentrate on developing mass movements opposed to the most pernicious effects of neoliberalism. I mean, the labor movement had always been there, and the attempt to organize peasants for land reform had always been there. But we're talking about movements in the 1980s and the 1990s in all of the Latin American countries that organized around more issues and different issues. They continued to organize about land reform and workers' rights and unions, but they also organized around a host of other issues and developed mass movements, very powerful mass movements. And the second thing that was different, they had different forms of mass movements than they had before. The second thing that was different was they engaged in electoral politics. They said armed revolt didn't work. In the case of Cuba, it did. No place else did it really turn out, to deliver lasting benefits. And so progressives, the mass movements, progressive movements, started to engage or work with political parties that were also running in elections. And that led to the election of a number of parties that and politicians and governments in Latin American countries in the 1990s and the 2000s that were built upon mass opposition to neoliberal forms of capitalism. Those countries included Argentina, Brazil. Those were more moderate responses. They also included Venezuela, Ecuador, and Bolivia, where both the movements and the governments and the politicians were more radical and in some cases looked beyond any form of capitalism. They didn't limit their opposition to neoliberal forms of capitalism, what Chavez eventually called a kind of 21st century socialism. So the first place on the world that started to talk about, think about, and work to try and achieve a 21st century version of socialism, something different from the 20th century socialism of the Soviet Union and Stalin, was Latin America. and the first region of the world that rejected the sort of neoliberal economic model was Latin America. So this was a very, very important experiment. These were very important things, and there were tremendous achievements in terms of economic well-being that these movements and these governments achieved. What has recently happened is they have had setbacks, and in almost every one of the Latin American countries, they've had setbacks. And there's a host of reasons for that that's very, very important for progressives and revolutionaries in Latin America to understand. And it's very important for progressives and revolutionaries in the rest of the world. When we're trying to learn lessons from people who have preceded us, in some ways, Latin America has been 5, 10, 15 years ahead of the rest of the world's political progressive movements and political parties and thinkers. So it's important that we have a tremendous amount we can learn from them, both their successes and, more recently, their failures, to try and figure out what it is that has to be done better.
You know, when I was thinking about the way the social movements mobilize and organize in Latin America, there is this unifying vision that a world with more equity functions better. And, you know, epidemiologists have been telling us all along that when you have a society that has more equality, you have less incidence of disease, you have less incidence of crime. There's all sorts of benefits for having a society that is more equal. And yet, you know, if you go to any business school in North America, they'll tell you that inequality is just part of capitalism. You know, it's just part of the equation. It's natural that recessions are just the order of the day. From an economics point of view, what are some of the lessons that we can highlight of the examples that Latin America has set out, but also the ways that the temporary setbacks we are experiencing highlight for the movement?
The essential difference is neoliberal capitalism preaches the necessity of inequality in order for the system to function. It's trickle-down economics. It says the corporations and the wealthy, you have to basically pay them a ransom in order for them to allow the productive resources to be used and for innovation to flourish. What Latin America was the first region of the world in response to this resurgence of neoliberal capitalism. What they said in response was, well, in our experience, as you have made us even more unequal, our economies have actually performed even worse. And that when the benefits of economic activity are distributed more equally, then not only is it more fair, not only are the goods and services going to where they can be used best, you know, $100 increase in income for somebody who is dirt poor produces a huge increase in well-being compared to $100 increase of income in somebody who's already a millionaire. The social movements and the political parties, the new progressive political parties like the Workers' Party in Brazil and the Socialist Party in Venezuela, what they also argued was, if you take a look at the evidence, you will see that when you have a more egalitarian distribution of income, growth and productivity actually works better. And there is overwhelming statistical evidence for this if you look back over the last 100 years. The idea that an unequal capitalist economy will outperform in productivity a more egalitarian capitalist economy, there is absolutely no evidence to substantiate that. As a matter of fact, there's overwhelming evidence that it's exactly the opposite. So one of the things that the movements opposed to neoliberalism in Latin America said loud and clear was, both because it's fair and because we believe it actually works better for, you know, economic performance, we are going to redistribute income, you know, from the very, very wealthy to people who have never enjoyed the benefits of economic development. And that is one of the successful things that the governments in Venezuela, the government in Venezuela, the government in Uruguay, the government in Argentina and Brazil, to a somewhat lesser extent, government in Ecuador, in Bolivia, they did that. they did a brilliant job of saying that we're going to now run the economy for ordinary people and no longer simply run it for the plutocrats, the oligarchs, the super wealthy. What they did not succeed in doing was changing institutional power so that when circumstances became somewhat more difficult, they would not suffer political rollbacks. That's what we are seeing. Two things have changed for Latin America in terms of its position in the world. One is a lot of the progress that was made in Latin America, and Venezuela is the best example of this, was when the U.S. government, quite frankly, was bogged down in intervention in the Middle East, disastrous intervention. If you've seen the Tolkien movies, the Lord of the Rings, it's as if the eye of Sauron was distracted from Latin America, and it was focused over on the Middle East. And as a result, the degree to which the United States usually meddles, intervenes, and invades whenever governments start to oppose neoliberalism and U.S. dominance, that lessened to some extent. And there was sort of a breathing period. The other thing that was very beneficial from the short-run perspective was China was growing at a rate like no large part of the global economy has ever grown at that pace for about a 20-year time period. So China was buying up agricultural and mineral and raw material exports from Latin America. So there was a very favorable international market for commodity exports from Latin America. That included oil. I mean, the one that was most obvious was oil in Venezuela, but it wasn't just oil. It was agriculture, mining, oil. So there was a very favorable market for Latin America for this exact period of time when you had successful political movements opposing neoliberalism, when you had the U.S. government distracted in the Middle East. And both those things have changed recently. The United States is less bogged down abroad. I think there's every reason to fear that whether it's a Trump government or a Clinton government, Hillary Clinton was the Secretary of State who basically tilted in favor of the coup d'etat in Honduras, even though the entire OAS said we won't recognize this new government that's thrown out a popular elected president. We're not going to recognize him, and the United States went ahead and said, well, we are, and we're going to go ahead. That was Hillary Clinton in the State Department. If she becomes president, there is no reason to believe that, you know, that she will be changing U.S. policy vis-a-vis Latin America in a beneficial direction. And the other thing that's happened is that the growth rate in China has slowed down, so that commodity prices have plummeted, and because Latin American economies continue to be dependent on those very profitable exports, they are facing more difficulties in terms of making their economies work well for everybody.
When you point out the very stark reality that we are faced with two candidates who, in terms of geopolitical, you know, offer very little to be hopeful for, I guess I want to bring the discussion back to the role of social movements, because in essence, social democracy is still a project that is, you know, trying to develop, to be exercised. You know, we have been working towards creating a political process that allows to elect people that will make choices and decisions in favor of the majority of the population, but that has not yet happened, you know. And capitalism is not a one-size-fits-all. There are various variations of capitalism, and perhaps it's important to note the difference this make, whether it's a liberal society, a socialist society, or a neoconservative form of capitalism.
There's neoliberal capitalism. Hopefully people understand what that is like. In the advanced economies, it gives rise to Occupy movements because it's tremendously inegalitarian. And in lesser developed economies, it essentially denies them the means and the mechanisms to develop their own go through their own industrialization process in ways that improves the overall productivity of their workforce. So that's neoliberal, and that's one kind of capitalism. There's been another kind of capitalism that reached sort of its peak in the Scandinavian countries. Over there, it's called social democracy or social democratic capitalism. I think it also is the kind of capitalism that the movements in Latin America and the political parties opposed to neoliberal capitalism did a pretty good job of building during the past 20 years. It's social democratic, it's populist, and it's redistributive capitalism, where you are redistributing goods and services from the wealthy to the poor. You're making sure, for instance, that the oil revenues are actually going to provide health care and clinics, you know, for poor neighborhoods, and to import food and necessities and to provide education for the next generation, rather than simply having the oil revenues in Venezuela go to finance the luxury, you know, living habits of the Venezuelan elite. The third kind of economy is a revolutionary democratic socialism. And some of the governments, some of the pink-tied governments in Latin America, were committed to trying to make a transition from populist redistributive capitalism to some form of revolutionary democratic 21st century socialism. I mean, in the aftermath of the failed coup in Venezuela, that was the turning point for the Chavez government. Up until then, they had been about redistribution. They had not really made any serious moves to sort of replace capitalism itself. But after that, they did start to move in that direction. They started to move in that direction with communes, the People's Communes, political force. They started to move in that direction with a new constitution that was much more democratic than the previous constitution. That was the government that made the greatest attempt to take this next step, to somehow go from trying to reorganize a capitalist economy so it would better serve the interests of the majority, to reorganizing the economy so that it was actually managed and run by and in the power and the hands of ordinary people. They made considerable strides in that direction, but they slowed down. And I think one of the lessons to be learned is that populist redistributive capitalism is not stable. That if you don't keep moving forward, and if you slow down the process of empowering the people who are benefiting from the redistribution to actually be in charge of the economy for themselves, that you always risk that when political circumstances become more difficult, that there will be huge setbacks. That's what's hopefully not going to happen in Venezuela, but appears to be a danger at this point. And it's certainly something we can already see has happened in Argentina and Brazil.
We're going to leave it there. Thank you so much for doing this. On our next segment, we will be talking with Dr. Hanel about the role of the very structures that co-create our economies and how do we engage in that process.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Visit Latin Waves Media to hear previous shows, to access resources, or support our efforts towards social change via community project engagement. Thank you and bye for now.